Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 74 of the Outlander podcast. She's Ginger.
And that's Summer.
And we are in love with all things Outlander.
So, announcements this week. We got a couple new shots from the Outlander Instagram account. Again, pretty standard, par for course, some behind-the-scenes shots from just different angles. We've got the car, Frank and Claire at the car in the 40s.
You said Frank and, I was like, Frank and what? Frank and Furter?
No.
Frank and,
Frank
got
and
it.
Beans. Frank and...
No.
Frank and Claire.
Claire is not Beans, and no. Neither is she a Furter.
No.
I mean, no.
Nope.
I just love that town. We need to go see. We need to go there one day.
We should. We'll get lots of pictures. We also got a shot of Katrina behind the scenes in... This looks like the scene when she's running toward the stones.
I think so.
And she's screaming, Frank! That one. She's got the cloak on, but she looks like she's either looking at a picture that somebody else took of her or that she's taking a picture of someone else. But part of me thinks that someone else took a picture that they're showing her.
Oh, you're right. Because it looks kind of weird. It's a little bit far from her face. You're right. I don't think about that, girl.
We finally, and this is so silly to me that it took this long for them to announce it, considering it's already been cast and filmed.
Yeah, but typically announcements or discoveries, if not formal announcements, of characters who are in upcoming episodes, at least with the first date, didn't happen if they weren't, you know, the big three or four, like Claire, Frank, who's the other one? Jamie?
For real.
Jamie. All that. Unless they're, you know, huge people like that, you're not going to get them up front. We understand because, number one, they're not needed yet. The stuff may not have been written at the time, and it was nowhere near being filmed. But now that you're right, everything's done, and everyone's been cast and, you know, paid and gone home, basically.
Right. I mean, they're moving towards season two right now, and for them to be just now announcing, like, but someone who's really pivotal.
I think he's in, didn't they say he's in 15 and 16?
He's probably, 15? It's got to be in the last two.
The last one or two. Yeah. The last, number 15 or 15 and 16.
Right.
I know he's in 15 at least. So, toward the end. So, I definitely, if we didn't hear during the break, which we did, but if we hadn't. I would have hoped we got McGranick right when it started back.
Right. Though kudos to the cast and crew for keeping this completely and utterly silent over the last, 6 months.
I'm not upset at all. I have not heard of him. I am overjoyed to see him as McGranick because...
Can we announce him? We haven't even said his name yet.
Oh, sorry. Go for it.
His name is Brian McCarty.
Mm-hmm.
He's been cast as McGranick, which, all of those things. I didn't say it because you kind of already said his name.
Sorry.
So.
We both very much, of course, look forward to all the episodes. But I think I have said before, if not on the show, definitely on Twitter, that I have mad love for Angus McFadden. I look forward to seeing Mr. McCarty. And he is on Twitter, so give him a follow. Yeah, so... McGranick, one of our favorite minor-ish characters from book one.
They are releasing a second edition of the first Outlandish Companion on March 31st, which basically covers the first four books. It'll be updated and revised. I'm not sure what they're going to update and or revise it with, but it'll be maybe TV show stuff. I'm not sure.
Well, Diana says on her Facebook post, quote, I removed a few chunks of obsolete material and replaced them with new material, including a couple of essays and a section on book to film, how we got from there to here, including hitherto unreleased photos from the Starz TV show.
Nice.
And, quote, a brief account of my career as a TV actor.
She's adorable.
Love it. Can't wait.
That's a funny. Okay. And apparently there will also be a second Outlandish Companion, which will cover the series from The Fiery Cross through Written in My Own Heart's Blood. Plus material on some of the Lord John novels and then some of the Bulges.
Might be out when, Summer?
Didn't I just say later this year?
Oh, if you did, then I missed it.
I thought
but
I
yes,
said it. If I didn't,
later
sometime later this year.
Dun, dun, dun!
This is big, y'all. This is big. We're super excited. There is finally a release date of sorts for the soundtrack of the series.
Volume 1.
Which...
So it looks like everything's going to be two volumes. The DVD, the soundtrack, the season.
I know. I'm like, they should have just said from the beginning that they were splitting the season into two parts. And you were going to have... The first season was going to be the first half of book one. And the second season was going to be the second half of book one.
I'm glad they didn't call it different things.
Well, they didn't. But you can't really call it the first season when you've got almost a year between...
It's 6 months. Come on now.
Oh my god, but it feels like so much longer.
Anyway.
And then it'll be at least a year until we get the next one, I'm sure.
Didn't we read like March or something of 2016?
It's an ungodly date. It's too far away.
A lot of shows... I mean, technically, if we waited a year between seasons, that's not unusual. It's just with this split... It seems awkward for us right now.
No, but, and it seems unfair to split it and then make us wait an entire year from the end.
I don't think unfair, but it does make this going from season one to two slightly different. But we're not waiting as long as would have if it were all run together.
I know, but we're so privileged and spoiled as Americans with our TV.
Well, not just as Americans. Hello, we're privileged and spoiled as Outlander fans.
No.
What other fandom gets the goodies that they give us every single week?
No, that's not even what I'm talking about.
What I'm talking about.
Like, British television series.
Oh, gosh.
They don't even have, like, seasons. They call them series. And it's, like, the first series of this, the second series. And some of them have, like, years in between them. Like, Sherlock, for crying out loud. Between the last season two and season three, there was a couple years. I mean, they're not run on the same schedules that we are, where we basically put one out every year. These people are working pretty much nonstop with a summer vacation or whenever their vacations
breaks,
are.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're totally spoiled in that we expect to adhere to
a certain schedule,
whereas I think they're falling in line more with the European release scheduling for their shows.
I think it was just the way the scheduling reflects. Well, the plan to do it in two parts does not necessarily reflect this, but the scheduling of when it came out or when they were able to debut it, to premiere it, was in line with, I guess, when they started filming. They filmed quite late. They got a late start. I think later than they had planned, but still, starting in October is quite late in a year. Looking no gift horse in the mouth, we're happy that this is happening. Any other series, and with Outlander, eventually, it will be this way as well. Look at Game of Thrones. Look at any show that has, you know, a semi-limited run, right? Or a limited number of episodes, 8 to 10, something like that. Black Sails, doesn't matter. Look at other Starz shows. You're waiting a year between seasons. You know, it's not some primetime, one of the big three or four networks where it's 8 to 9 months out of the year with, you know, a few breaks where it's all fall and all spring. And they, as you said, get the summer off and everything. We're not going to get that many episodes. This is a little bit of a big show here.
But think about the Black Sails fans. Like, they waited. It's going to feel like even longer than that. Like, they've been done filming second season since August when we met with the people on the tartan carpet.
I understand that, but fans only finished watching it last January, February.
I know, but I'm just saying to have it in the can for as long as they're going to have it
in the
can.
So you don't mean fans. You mean the Starz?
All of it. Like, the people who want to watch
actors.
It. Like, to have the stuff done and ready to go, but they're not airing it, has to be maddening.
Well, because done does not mean done. Finished filming does not mean finished with post-production and finished with soundtrack and finished, you know, and that's why there are many things. And it's a lot of things that we've learned, too, in this whole thing. It's interesting. But we are just
bringing
it back. To bring it back,
the release date is set for February 10th. It will be released soundtrack volume 1 in digital and CD formats.
And again, we're not quite there, but the countdown is marching on. We've got this in February, and just, you know, with more news that comes out from production, from Starz, and just little things, and with the award shows that we just had, and, you know, as we go, this is getting easier, not easy, but easier and easier, and plus we're getting closer. Things are helping us get through Droughtlander.
Correct.
And having things like this is great.
It'll be one more thing we can do while we wait.
Oh, yeah.
Canadians got their announcement of when their Droughtlander will be ending, which is, lucky for them, one day after ours.
No more waiting 2 or 3 weeks.
Right. It'll be literally the day after. So Canadian Droughtlander will be ending on April 5th, 2015. And that is announcements, my friend.
Woohoo! That's pretty quick and dirty.
Didn't feel that quick and or dirty. Though you kind of made it dirty at one point.
We deleted that part.
So next, we will be moving on to our read-along.
And now on to our read-along. This week, we are covering chapter 13
Poor Snuffy.
I know. Chapter 13 of Dragonfly and Amber, entitled Deceptions.
Although this is a work of fiction, as most books, it touches on some very human themes. Some topics, such as the one in this short chapter, are extremely difficult to discuss. Our intention in this discussion is to keep it to the book and not to provide our opinions of procedures, our own opinions. And I think that's a good kind of disclaimer.
I mean, it's
good. It's a difficult topic, but I think we'll do a pretty good job because we're not talking about the topic itself. We're talking about it in
the context of this chapter. The book. But we're not advocating one way or the other.
No, that's
what I mean.
I would
say it's a hot button topic, yes. Not a difficult topic.
A discussion of it in the context of the chapter, I don't think will be difficult.
Okay.
The topic itself is a hot button topic.
No, of course it's hot
which
button.
Makes it difficult in any situation. Chapter 13 opens with Claire giving a description of herbs.
Governor?
Have you ever heard of black hellebore or hellebore?
I've heard of none of those things. And honestly, I hadn't ever heard of anything being described as an angel maker.
We haven't gotten there yet.
I know, I'm just saying.
So this list of ingredients that Claire has is something she doesn't even really like to touch. She laid it down as though it were slimy, she says. And then we learn that she got the concoction from Madame Rouleau. And that Madame is the best of the angel makers, as you said. And that it's dangerous, the concoction.
Legit, though. That's like one of the most specific job descriptions. Because it encompasses pretty much exactly what they do. But if it wasn't associated with that, not knowing the context, part of me, it makes me think of like the Make-A-Wish Foundation. We're like, oh, we're wish makers. You know, we're here to grant wishes. But then in the context of the story, it's like angel maker.
I am horrified by what you just said. And I hope no one from Make-A-Wish ever hears anything that you just said. Because that is the most awful thing you've ever brought into this show.
You shouldn't take away from this.
Oh, Lord have mercy. People, you have my permission to turn it off now. That was embarrassing.
I'm not saying that the Make-A-Wish Foundation is in any way, shape, or form connected with abortions. I am saying, however, that it was such a benign, like almost a sweet title until you really thought about it.
What
you're
it
like,
is.
Oh.
That I don't disagree with. It is a very, it sounds like, oh, that's kind of sad and touching and not sweet, but, you know, bittersweet, right? No, not bittersweet. Sad and touching and kind of, aw, that's kind of... I know what you're saying. It's not cute. It's not sweet. But I get what you're saying.
But it seems like a title that could be held at almost any other, like, workplace. Like, oh, she's the angel maker.
She does the great... Oh,
right. Yeah. She does these great things.
Except
the context in this story is completely different.
The title, for what it does, is horrible.
Oh, my gosh.
But really... If you have to do something like that,
it's horrible, but I think it's maybe perhaps a necessary position for someone to hold in society.
Someone's going to do it.
Somebody needs to.
So Claire, this concoction she has, is in possession of, what did you call it earlier?
Stop.
Just
She's making fun of me because I can't pronounce it. When I look at the word.
How does it look to
me?
You,
it
Summer?
Looks like. She's so already making fun of me and I haven't even said it yet.
You did it once very
earlier. And by very well, she means that I said it completely wrong and she laughed in my face.
I loved it, though. I was like, it took me a second. And then I realized what she was trying to say and I went, oh, Summer.
All right, y'all. I'm going to do it because I love you. What I said was abortificant. And that's not what it is.
I don't even think it was that good last time.
It
was not that good.
How could it have been worse than that?
I don't know, but it was. And the word is abortifacient.
Okay, but still. I definitely
but
hit
she
the hard
added,
C.
She did. And she also, you added a syllable somehow. I don't know how you did it, but you did it earlier. Anyway, so I didn't like piss myself laughing, but.
Oh, she laughed in my face.
And then she said,
I don't want to talk about this, but you definitely need to say that later when we record.
So abortifacient, yes. That's what the concoction she had was. Then when Louise asks if Claire has used it,
since she described it so convincingly and what it did and how horrible or how painful it could be, Claire replies with vehemence, God, no!
Right?
I don't know what to say. I wrote down, and Summer can help me. Let's chat about this. Okay. I wrote, first of all, judgmental much? First of all, hold on. Secondly, I wrote, it was definitely a gut reaction, one she couldn't control because she wasn't expecting that question. So I can't be too judgmental on that. But do you think Claire's, I mean, she's offering a service to her friend. She's willing to do it. What do you think is behind her strong reaction and reply?
Well, I think perhaps, and this is just me, like, guesstimating. I have no actual knowledge of this, but I have no actual knowledge of many things, but I try to speak on them anyway. But my instinct tells me that this is almost like Diana talking. Like, this is her opinion on that subject. And it's like modern day subjects coming into this, like, historical book and being, like, put out there in a way that's, you know, accessible. But to me, it seems very clearly that it is, I am 100, that Claire, if it's just Claire, that Claire is 100% not pro that. But I think she's also science-minded enough that she knows that it's not practical
you
for
could her. Say science-minded, but she has at least one, if not more, flashes in this chapter alone of how she may not do something for herself, but it's also, look at the situation she's in. The baby she is carrying is by a husband whom, regardless of how they were brought together, the marriage-wise, she's deeply in love with, and they want this baby. So the condition is, the circumstances are completely different. Okay, they both are pregnant, but they have different situations. Claire works, spends her days in this hospital where she sees women dying in pain from the angel makers gone wrong, or the non-successful angel maker whatever.
Well, but honestly, that's all that there was in a time when it wasn't legal.
That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is Claire knows about, she's able to get the stuff.
Yeah.
So she knows that it can go desperately wrong, and those are the ones that she sees or has seen at the hospital. Claire tells, and this is just what I said, Claire tells the reader, the successes of the angel makers were not the ones who came to the hospital. Ellen G. writes, opening with a recipe for an abortifacient. Interesting that a pregnant woman would do this at this time. Would do that in this time. It is not a business deal, in parentheses, whore, but a high-level friendship. Thinking on this, Claire would have probably helped someone in her own time, so her 20th century sensibility is also reflected here. Angel makers, those who make angels from their actions. Such a sweet label for this. So Ellen, you're kind of saying what Summer is saying. I don't like I'm making an assumption here, and I could be wrong. I don't think you both mean sweet, like, aw, puppies, sweet, beautiful babies. No, you mean it's like a sad sweet. I get what you're saying. No, I wouldn't use that word.
It's like they're trying to make it
sound a little bit better.
Yeah, then, I mean, they're not just saying, hey, we murder babies. They're saying, sure, we make angels. It's marketing. It's a fantastic marketing ploy.
Marketing.
Whew. It is marketing. It's like, what, 18th century marketing?
Yeah, I didn't think about that way, but okay.
But what I will say is that Claire didn't make this. She didn't make this.
No, she got it from Master Raymond.
Right. She got it from somebody else.
The Madame.
Claire didn't give it to her. Yeah. The Madame. Claire didn't give it to her.
Claire got it.
No, it sounded to me that Louise had it and was like, this is what I got. And Claire was like, I wouldn't take this. I don't recommend it.
We learned that she got the concoction from Madame Rouleau.
Oh, she says, I got it. Okay.
Yeah, so Claire gets it from Madame Rouleau. Now, Ellen shared with us a link. It is with, if I remember reading the headline or the top of the webpage correctly, it is with the wording, I don't think it uses the word politics, I'm adding this, but with the words, with the admonition, something like politics, religion, opinion, everything else aside, this link that we will share, that LNG shared with us, but it basically is the history of the procedure that has been performed in one way or another for millennia. And it's been around. That's all we're saying. It's from, you know, from ancient Greece, earlier times, etc. So it's just, it's a very interesting read. It's, of course, not an easy read, but it's a very interesting read. So Louise is truly miserable. She doesn't want to die and doesn't want to give up or lose the baby. Claire gets practical. Does Louise want to keep the child? She asks. Yes. She wants it because she made it with Charles. She feels that using the concoction is the only choice she has. Otherwise, she would be cast out by her husband, and she may even be excommunicated by the church. When Claire suggests that Louise allow her husband, Jules, to believe it's his child, Louise looks horrified. Sleep with Jules? But Charles would be furious! I don't know why that makes me laugh. Claire replies, Charles is not pregnant.
True that. I just read an article online today, and I think I saw it on Janet Katsawan. Is that how it's pronounced?
I believe
I'm super bad at that. And Katsawan. Janet, I'm sorry if you're listening. That she posted about, and it was kind of like one of those, like, I don't know. It was an article that was very pointed about there's all these, like, anti-whatever, and they're all men that are all putting all these things, and it had this headline of, I wish, like, something about, I wish all these men could carry all of these, like, I wish there was a way, like, some modern science way, to implant all of these zygotes into these men, into these men who love them so much that could carry them to term, since they're so, like, gung-ho about being active in that role. But, you know, not thinking about what it actually does to someone else.
So Louise starts to consider this new option. Charles knows of the baby, and that's why they fought. Charles said the baby was her fault and that she, quote, should have waited until he'd reclaimed his father's throne.
Right, because she totally had a choice in that.
Because she totally just went, okay, pop, baby. Pop, there's a baby.
Because, you know, the second you go, I'm going to put a baby in myself,
it happens.
It happens.
I wrote, the lols, for real? She should have waited? That makes me laugh.
Like, that's such a man thing to say, though. Like, for real. How could you do this? How could I do this? You were a willing participant in that.
Claire appeals to Louise's feelings for Charles and does admit that the prince has a streak of romanticism. Perhaps he could be persuaded to go with the flow. Also, she would need Jamie's help. Ellen shares, I love the way Claire finds a way to lead Louise into trying to get her husband into bed to take care of the paternity issues. Like, very sly. You know what? At that point, dude, you gotta do what you gotta do. So this is sort of an intersection of the work she does at L'Hôpital and in her social life in France.
That's gonna be, like, the largest premature baby ever.
Hers and Charles?
Mm-hmm.
How?
Because if she successfully convinces her husband that it's his, she's at least, what, six to eight weeks along?
Yeah, okay.
Which means she's gonna try to put... fawn it off
on him. She could have a quote-unquote early baby.
Right, that's what I'm saying. It's going to be the largest premature baby ever.
When she leave Louise's...
Really? That was so not grammatically nice. Okay, ever. When she leave Louise's...
Do I need to leave that in there?
Probably.
When she leaves Louise's, the latter is all dolled up, getting ready for dinner with her husband. Well, dinner and then some. Okay, so when Jamie,
oh, and you're not even drinking.
No, I don't drink now.
Like, she straight up was like, no, I can't drink. And could you imagine what would have just happened?
I probably would have done better.
Had you been, you would have done better?
Okay, when she, Claire, is with Jamie, and he says, do you think the fur merchant is more likely to be Louis of France or his minister Duvigny? I was a little bit shocked, given the previous trip Claire made to Louise's. Ahem. Do you not follow my thoughts? Given Claire's previous, not the one she just got back from, but the previous that we know of, stint with Louise.
Calling it a fur merchant?
There you go.
Yeah, for sure.
Jamie's going over some letters, trying to decipher the pseudonyms in them aloud, and Claire is lost. When she goes over to him and she sees the signature, she's surprised. Fergus has been able to get the letters after all. Fergus says... It is nothing, my lord, after describing how and where he'd gotten the letters.
Legit? Did that just happen? Yeah. Like, for real? After we did that whole thing?
Oh, love her. Well, then I think in this one case only, it's okay that I didn't turn my phone on silent, because that ding we all just heard, that I will not edit out, is actually it wasn't a text message. It was an alert. Mm-hmm. But it was an alert from a DM that I got, that we got from Outlander Plans. Hello, Marie. Thank you so much. You didn't know you were going to be kind of like
featured.
Well, I told her we were asking. She knows we asked her, and I would give her credit. But she may not know that her alert came to us right as we were recording. And I had asked for some help pronouncing that plant, and I think I did it somewhat as she's suggesting. Marie, I'm going to use your pronunciation, even though we've already said it, but I'm going to do it now in case I need to correct myself. Okay, it is hellebore.
Hellebore.
Hellebore. Thank you so much, at Outlander Plans. And if you're not following her, please do. She is, I almost said an edible. No.
No, but a lot of plants are.
Yes, I know. She is very kind, extremely knowledgeable, and writes some of the most, her and Outlander Anatomy are some of the most interesting blogs that are, you know, tangentially related to Outlander. I love it. So if you're not following her, give her a follow. It's hellebore.
And it's hellebore.
Sorry. Where were we? Oh, okay. Wow.
Fergus
says, it is nothing, my lord, after describing how and where he'd gotten the letters. Claire has a sudden vision, quote, of that fine-boned hand held squirming on a block with an executioner's blade raised above the broomstick wrist.
Dun, dun, dun. That's not foreshadowing at all.
Never. Claire copies the letter, and then Jamie reseals it. Fergus remarks on Jamie's hand. We are reminded that Wentworth was merely 4 months ago. Does it seem like that recent to you in this story?
No, but I would also like to say that this is the first, like, hand update we've had since the book began. Like, the update after her, like, rudimentary surgery she performed in McGranick's living room. This is the first time it's even been discussed. Far as the results of her impromptu surgery, considering she's not a surgeon, she's a nurse. So, this is the first mention we've had of how he's been recuperating.
That's true, because it wasn't just... I mean, Fergus remarked on his hands like, oh, it's too bad, my lord, that your hand is basically crap. And then Claire was basically gave us a good paragraph about it described it pretty much detail, how much motion it had, that she had given him like a ball of, like, not yarn, a ball of material or whatever she had made for him to squeeze and help regain the motility or the strength in the hand.
Mm-hmm. Oh my god, this is totally tangential, but you know those stress balls?
Yeah, that's those, like, kind of what it was.
I know, but reminded those, like, me of. I know, but those, like, liquid filled stress balls. They're filled with like a silicone kind of a gel.
Okay.
So I'm a job. One of the people that works there has, like, super antsy. Like, super antsy, can't be still. Has to stand the whole time. Has to stand all day. Mm-hmm. Can't, if he doesn't have, like, a pen he's clicking in his hand, he's got something, he has to be doing something all the time. So they got him this stress ball, and apparently in the middle of one of his calls he popped the stress ball and he, like, walked into, like, the conference room where his conference was going on with like
gel,
whatever gel was all over his hand, like, I don't know what just happened.
That's kind of gross.
So that happens. Be careful with stress balls, they can't take all of your stress.
Then Fergus goes to return the letters. They had a private supper themselves, and Claire tells Jamie about Louise and the baby. He agrees with her solution. He doesn't like that it's a filthy trick to play on a man, but he doesn't know what she's to do otherwise.
I mean, he's practical about it. I mean, I think he's seeing it from several angles. He's seeing it as a man, and as a person that could potentially have that scheme used on. So he's like, in that regard, that's really crappy that you would do that to somebody. And then he's thinking, but what other choice does she have?
Well, there's an interesting comparison I like to, well.
Did I pronounce that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's talk about this. So, okay. Whereas in the last chapter, or maybe two chapters ago, Jamie expressed, he's like this. We're all multifaceted, so we're not all one thing all the time. We're always meant more than one thing. But whereas in the last chapter, or at least a very recent chapter, Jamie was rather high and mighty, married, moral Jamie, snuggled up in bed with his lawfully married wife. In this chapter, now, since he's now breaking the law, he's not so quick to judge or condemn. He says, "Besides, it doesn't have become me to be taken a high moral stand about other people's behavior. Stealing letters and spying and trying generally to subvert a man my family holds as king, I shouldn't have liked to have someone judging me on the grounds of the things I'm doing, Sassenach." So Jamie has changed, or is this simply a different situation? What do you think? Because remember before when it was Charles crawling on and getting bit by monkeys and taking his thing and having being cold and in pain the whole night on the way home? Jamie was curled up with his wife and was like very, he was pretty, and we giggled about it, but he was very self-righteous, Jamie. He was.
But that's pretty par for the course. It's human. Because he's human. And that's what's so great about Diana's characters is that they are flawed. They're super flawed. And they're all super human. And they all have these character traits. Like, none of them are... I don't think any one of them is 100%, you know, white or black. You know, if this was like a chessboard, you know, good and evil. I don't think either one... There's a single character who's 100% bad or 100% good. With the exception of Blackjack. I may think he's 100% bad. I can't find redemption in him. But almost everybody else, even though they're colored and they have, you know, some smut on their auras, if you will, there's still some good in them.
Jamie is definitely a moral man. He's trying to save 10,000 lives, he says. Louise is trying to save one. Jamie is putting her, Claire, Fergus, and Jared's business at risk. She's putting Jules at risk. So yeah, what he's saying is we're both doing something that we think we need to do, and the way we're doing it is to save a life. The reason we're doing it is to save a life. So who am I to judge how that is done when look what I'm doing?
Yeah. No, he's, like I said, he's a pragmatist. Like 100%, Jamie is.
In the end, he's not too troubled over the letters.
No, no.
He says, "It may come to much worse than that before we've done, Claire, and I canna say ahead of time what my conscience will stand. It's best not to test it too soon." Very well said. So they look at the letter. Jamie says that almost anyone would want to intercept His Highness's mail. Louis spies, Duvernay's, Philip of Spain's, Jacobite lords, and ones who might turn Jacobite, the Pope, and on and on. He says the seal had been removed about 3 times before he took it off. Jimmy reminds her that they can't trust anyone and that there may be spies among the servants. Jamie says that he can trust her, Jenny, Ian, and Murta with his life, and that he has. She says 4 people isn't that many. Kind of makes it kind of sad. And he replies that it's 4 more than Charles Stewart has. And he's probably right. They go to sleep, and in the morning, they each wake up before sunrise, and they take turns basically giving each other goose flesh. Claire describes her body...
That sounds so inappropriate.
Goose flesh?
Yeah, they take turns giving each other...
Well, they do.
I know. I'm just saying it sounds inappropriate. Okay. That's all I'm saying.
Claire describes her body becoming fuller and more sensitive due to the pregnancy day by day. Jamie asks her, basically, if she'll let him suckle after the baby is there, and she says... Always. Ellen says, so sad the last couple of lines about Claire allowing Jamie access to her breast milk when the baby comes. Claire's answer, always. I wrote in the book, OMG. You know, it makes me think, yes, it's literal. Will you let me do this once the baby comes, right? And couldn't it also be symbolic? She will always be there for him, be wanting to give him life or sustenance or hope or whatever it is.
I hope it's symbolic.
No matter the time, his age, etc. Because obviously we know things happen.
No, I know, and it has to be symbolic, but I'm not going to lie.
You don't want to say anything more?
No, it's just that whole, like, the image of, like, I don't know. It's, like, one thing to be like, dude, can I try it? But it's another to be like, will you let me drink from you? I'm like, I don't know. It's a little skeevy to me. Just a little skeevy. And I love Jamie. But it's a little skeevy.
Yeah, I almost had a Les Mis song there. But instead of, I say, I almost said drink to me instead of sing with me. No. Oh, well. So that's chapter 13.
That is chapter 13. Please come back next week when we discuss chapter 14, which will be meaty.
Not meaty. It will not be meaty. It better not be meaty.
Mediations of the flesh. On the flesh. Okay, stop. Join us next week when we will be discussing chapter 14, Mediations on the Flesh.
Wait, no, what?
No, we're not doing chapter 14. Summer. Mediations on the flesh.
Can you try that one more time, maybe?
I mean, I pronounced it.
No, you did not.
I did so.
Try that word again.
Meditations. Okay.
That took me a few times to realize that it was not right. Okay, she's fired. She will not read any more titles anymore. It's okay, my job.
Come back next week when we'll be discussing chapter 14, Meditations on the Flesh. Mediations would be an equally interesting chapter, but that's not what it's entitled.
Not as interesting as meditating on flesh.
We could mediate on it.
What? While sitting on
sure,
it?
Sure, let's mediate on it.
Never. Okay, thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/outlanderpod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.
I dreamt it last night.